You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Hall of Fame, the Super Speaker, 2 days in the life of Nancy Pelosi, impeachment champion, political grandmaster. Photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Lost in the wilderness of the Trump era, Democrats looked long and hard for a champion. Robert Mueller, the media, even Michael Avenatti. But when the party retook the House in November 2018 and Nancy Pelosi began her historic second term as Speaker, no one doubted the search was over. Often dismissed as a San Francisco liberal, she's now the indispensable Democrat, contesting with the squad and centrist alike, winning with substance and imagery, holding fire on impeachment until precisely the right moment. The speaker talks to Abigail Tracy about the road to impeachment, how the Democrats won in 2018, why Trump is unique among presidents she's known, why her job is like weaving, and the work to be done after Trump is gone. Tell me about the moment you reached the decision to go down the impeachment path. I take a lot of guidance from the vision of our founders, and our founders fought very hard for our democracy, for our country, for our Constitution. In the dark days of revolution, Thomas Paine said, "The times have found us." We believe that the times have found us to keep the Republic from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that would be those who say things like, "Article 2 says I can do whatever I want." That's not a republic. That's a monarchy. That's not what we have. How did your experience as a legislator during the Bill Clinton impeachment shape your view? The Clinton impeachment was totally, totally wrong for our country. The president, of course, was personally wrong to do what he did, but that's not an impeachable offense. I was very concerned at the time, because I do take impeachment seriously, that the Republicans were using it very frivolously and were disrespectful to the Constitution. When I became Speaker, people wanted me to impeach President George W. Bush over the war in Iraq. They were misrepresenting to American people what was happening in Iraq. But I didn't think you could impeach one president and then go impeach the next president. And then that would become a way of life for our country. Many of your members, especially after the Mueller report, were eager to impeach, but you resisted. Why? There is plenty of grist for the mill in the Mueller report, but not the actual what was the obstruction of justice about. With Ukraine, we had what his violation of the Constitution was about. It just made all the difference in the world. It was the dawning of a new day, crossing the Rubicon, any analogy you want to use or metaphor you want to use. We had no choice. I had no choice but to go forward, especially after the president admitted it to me on the phone without even any embarrassment about what he did and got caught doing. Compare Trump to other presidents you worked with. While we had our differences of opinion, even with President George W. Bush, they believed in governance. Trump doesn't believe in governance, so it's very hard to see what would motivate him to do something really good and transformative. The only thing that he has accomplished, and it's sad to say for our country, is a tax cut that will give 83% of the benefits to the top 1%. And he thinks that's an accomplishment. Have you been at all surprised by the behavior of the broader Republican Party in the Trump era? No, I'm not surprised. I mean, their oath of office is clearly to Donald Trump, and not to the Constitution of the United States. Forgetting his personal grotesqueness, there is nothing he is about in terms of the issues that they haven't been there longer and worse. How do you keep your finger on the pulse of your caucus? I do consider myself a weaver, that I'm at this loom, and I'm weaving, and I want every thread to be in the tapestry, whether it's the big tent of where we are, generationally, gender, gender ID, philosophically, ethnically, all of that adds strength to it. And in order to take advantage of all that strength, it's important to respect what the difference is that it brings to the tapestry. That's what we are, the Democratic Party. We are not a rubber stamp, lockstep party as the Republicans are. We have our beautiful diversity, and that, again, is our strength. One thing people say is that I can bring people together. I don't unify them. Our values do. And in the photos, July 25th, 11 a.m., on the balcony off the Speaker's chamber in the red Max Mara coat she famously wore after her triumphant border wall shutdown meeting with Trump and Senator Chuck Schumer. July 25th, 10:01 a.m., with Representatives Steny Hoyer, Ilhan Omar, and others minutes before a press event to celebrate the 200th day of her party's majority in the House. July 24th, 9 a.m., at the Democratic Caucus meeting on the agenda is the budget deal Pelosi is negotiating with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. At the caucus meeting with Representative Maxine Waters. Members wait at the caucus meeting. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, Robert Mueller is on the stand. July 24th, noon, in her office with Schumer, Representative Adam Smith, and Senator Jack Reed, discussing defense funding. July 24th, 5 p.m., Pelosi is greeted by a scrum of reporters as she leaves the speaker's meeting. July 24th, 5:45 p.m., prepping for a press availability while conferring with Representatives Adam Schiff, Elijah Cummings, and Jerry Nadler, and her top aides. And July 25th, 9:53 a.m., conferring with members at a Democratic whip meeting.
Thank you.
The Ways of the Jet Cult by William D. Cohan. How the private jet became the singular fetish and status marker of the modern super rich. Opening photos, first class, a Ken Folk designed private jet interior, and the fractional ownership FlexJet G650. In the summer of 1999, soon after Teddy Forstman, the late billionaire pioneer of leveraged buyouts, completed the sale of Gulfstream, the private jet manufacturer, to General Dynamics, Gulfstream's board of directors asked him what he wanted as a gift for successfully engineering the company's turnaround and sale. It turned out to be the very moment private jets went from being merely an exclusive form of fast transportation to a form of rarefied and much coveted currency. Forstman Little, Forstman's private equity firm, had bought Gulfstream for about $850 million from the Chrysler Corporation in 1990. When he opened the box, Forstman found a bloated, poorly run business. He was pissed. But rather than sit back and watch the company descend into seemingly inevitable bankruptcy, Forstman eventually took over as CEO, reversed Gulfstream's fortunes, engineered an initial public offering in 1996, and then sold the company for $5.3 billion. In 9 years, he had delivered to investors a $5 billion profit on an original equity investment of about $200 million. The deal became legendary on Wall Street. "I'm an artist, and Gulfstream was a big canvas," Forstman once told me in an interview about a decade ago. Robert Strauss, the ultimate Washington insider and Akin Gump partner, was chairman of the Gulfstream board, which Forstman had stacked with his friends, a variety of luminaries and powerful former government officials such as Henry Kissinger, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, George Shultz, Roger Penske, Michael Ovitz, and Lynn Forrester. "What do you want?" Strauss asked Forstman. "We've got to give you something. What about some options?" "I own so much stock," the canny Forstman replied. "I don't want to have options." Forstman thought about Strauss's request and called him back. "I know what I want," Forstman told him. "I want a G5, referring to the company's then state-of-the-art private jet. "Holy shit," Strauss replied, stunned at the audacity of Forstman's request. "Think about it," Forstman said to him. "It's $40 million. You were going to give me more than $40 million worth of stock anyway." Strauss conceded that point to Forstman and then discussed the novel request with the Gulfstream board. Needless to say, Forstman got his own personal Gulfstream V. One of the revelations of the Jeffrey Epstein scandal was the degree to which the private jet has become the definitive, highly overdetermined artifact of modern super money culture. Epstein's plane, even if it was an older second-hand model, certified his wealth, earned him chits with academics and former presidents, served as a stage where he could perform his grift, and, of course, helped him groom his prey in his sick sex scheme. Private air travel dazzles everyone, and once you fly this way, you're hooked. Former presidents like to ride on private jets. Bill Clinton, of course, who's famously, problematically addicted to private jets, but also Barack Obama. Donald Trump has placed a model of one of the two yet-to-be-configured Air Force Ones smack dab in the middle of the Oval Office. Harvard scientists, Nobel Prize winners, narcissistic defense attorneys love to fly private, too. Setting foot on the tarmac confers an irresistible, intoxicating feeling of specialness. Avoiding security is the very definition of modern luxury, marking a bright line between private jet owners and their lucky guest, and the merely rich. Even first-class commercial flyers, with their little glasses of champagne, their special blankets, are schmucks, fenced off in pens, forced to take off their shoes like everyone else. Private jets have become the essential element of modern super-rich business and pleasure infrastructure, woven in deeply the communal living space for the most acquisitive, rapacious people in the world. Can you imagine how inconvenient it would be for the global elite to talk about climate change at the World Economic Forum in Davos, or at the Allen and Company Sun Valley Conference, or at the Aspen Institute in Colorado, or at the Bilderberg meetings this year in Montreux, Switzerland, without traveling there on their private jets? A personal commercial-size private jet was not yet the coin of the rich guy realm when Forstmann made his bold request. Hugh Hefner made a big show of having a plane, an airborne Playboy mansion, and, of course, there was Air Force One since 1962, the definitive superpower ride. Jackie Kennedy's Robin's Egg Blue paint job was the customization, beginning to show what was possible when you had power over your own plane. But during the 90s, the trend definitely began to build. Business titans got addicted. Jack Welch, the legendary CEO of GE, who turned the company into the most valuable and most admired in the world, also put a premium on having unlimited free access to a private jet after he retired in 2001. He had gotten used to traveling privately as a GE executive. Thanks to an employment and post-retirement consulting agreement with GE that Welch signed in December 1996, he would have access to GE aircraft for unlimited personal use and business travel, among other perquisites. The precise details of Welch's delicious post-retirement contract were not fully known from GE's public filings. But in 2002, in the middle of his acrimonious divorce from Jane Beasley Welch, his second wife of 13 years, she revealed the details in a court filing. Jane Welch's expert valued her ex-husband's annual use of a GE-owned Boeing 737 at about $3.5 million, or nearly $300,000 per month. The essential purpose of a Gulfstream 5 of one's own or unlimited access to a Boeing business jet was to keep a safe distance from the masses. What the writer Tom Wolfe described in The Bonfire of the Vanities as a need to insulate, insulate, insulate. It may be even truer today, except that the Gulfstream 5 has become the G650ER, the speed record holder for the farthest flight in private jet history, going from Singapore to Tucson, a distance of 8,379 nautical miles. And there are other options for the top 1% of the 1% than there were in 1999, when Gulfstream sold 141 planes before the company had any serious competition. Now Bombardier makes the much-coveted Global Express jet. Textron's Cessna division makes the Citation Longitude, an upgrade from its beloved Citation X. Boeing still makes a business jet, as do Dassault and Embraer. For the aspirational class, mere eight-figure millionaires, there's been the rise and acceptance of fractional jet operators, such as NetJets, which Forstmann had a hand in starting and is now owned by Warren Buffett, and the upstart Wheels Up, which just raised $128 million at a valuation of more than $1 billion. A jet often announces a super-rich arrival. One of the first things the Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page did after becoming billionaires, thanks to the IPO of Google in 2004, was to buy a used Boeing 767-200 from Qantas, the Australian airline, for $15 million, a relative bargain, and then spend another $10 million refurbishing it with two staterooms, a shower, a dining area, a lounge, and 15 first-class seats, and the ability to seat 50 passengers. That was only the beginning. Reportedly since then, Blue City Holdings, the company they created to own their jet fleet, has bought another 8 jets, including 2 Gulfstream 5s and another Boeing, and built a private hangar at a cost of around $82 million in San Jose, California. It's not at all a surprise, given that their owners have reached the World Series of acquisitiveness, that jets are highly competitive, subject to constant comparisons of size and number. A few years back, I wrote a profile in this magazine about Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, the Saudi prince and businessman who was then worth around $27 billion. He was one of the largest shareholders in Citigroup, News Corporation, Apple, and Twitter. He had a lot of toys, among them a Boeing 747 outfitted with a gold throne and a Hawker Siddeley 125. He told me he was the only private citizen with a Boeing 747, and the rumors that Brin and Page had one were not true. He said he knew they had a Boeing 787. In fact, it was the customized 767-200. He had also just bought an Airbus A380, the only private citizen to order one of those. Mark Cuban, the billionaire tech entrepreneur, Shark Tank regular, and owner of the Dallas Mavericks, bought his first private jet, a Gulfstream 5, on the internet for $40 million. After his pilot gave the plane a test drive and approved of it, Cuban wired the money. "I bought it to save time," he emailed me. "I'm a believer that time is the most valuable asset we can't own. Anything I can do to spend more time with family is a win." He has since bought 2 Boeing jets, one of which he had specially redesigned to accommodate the Mavericks. A private plane is alchemical, translating a 9-figure bank account into actual power. Harder than it sometimes looks for some people. For people who are actually not that powerful, except that they have a lot of money, it gives them a calling card to have power, one private equity mogul explains to me. It's all about currency. They get to leave when they want, they get to arrive when they want, and they get to make their friends be on their schedule. And then, if they are really dicks, they can leave them when they are late. Forstman once did that to a guy who was 20 minutes late for a flight after he got stuck in heavy Manhattan traffic during the annual United Nations General Assembly meeting. When another passenger on the plane asked Forstman to wait, he was told, "F him, I've got things to do." A private jet forms covalent bonds of the kind that pay off later, to the acquisitive class, just about the only kind that matter. A ride in a private jet creates people that owe you something, debts, if only of gratitude. There's this whole New York to Florida trade on the weekends in the winters where it's like, "Hey, you want a ride?" continues the executive, because it's not like they fly capacity. You use your NetJet and you take one person. You can curry 7 favors. You are like king for the day. Who knows the amount of goodwill that Steve Rattner, the former investment banker and Obama car czar, generated by giving MSNBC host Joe Scarborough an occasional lift back and forth to Martha's Vineyard on the Dassault Falcon 2000 jet that Rattner pilots himself. Rattner and his charts has been a Morning Joe regular feature for years. One's jet is one's castle, where the billionaire makes the rules. These can get pervy. According to an age discrimination lawsuit filed and later settled by a male pilot against Mike Jeffries, then the CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch, there were strict rules, contained in a 47-page manual for how the young, male, scantily clad models were supposed to behave. While crewing on the company's Gulfstream G550, male flight crew were told to present themselves clean-shaven in a uniform of Abercrombie polo shirts, boxer briefs, flip-flops, and gloves, black for when handling silverware, and white for laying the table, and wearing a spritz of the retailer's own brand of aftershave. Next photos, Hugh Hefner and Barbie Benton on his private jet, Big Bunny, in London, 1970. Jeffrey Epstein's private plane in Palm Beach, 2018. Bill Clinton in Mariam Island in July. There is also an infamous story about the time a group of clothing executives was flying back from a fashion show in Europe. A female model was also on board. It was Halloween time. The plane was festooned with little gourds and miniature pumpkins. These guys were all effing hammered, says someone familiar with the incident, and were throwing the pumpkins at each other on the plane, and I guess they threw one and hit the model in the face and cut her eye. They trashed the airplane. He says the model sued for the damage done to her face. The jet owner sent the executives a bill for $80,000. Epstein's plane, like his townhouse, was oversexed, kitschy. It was really cheesy with the zebra skins and the leopard pillows, says Jim Dowd, one of Epstein's substitute former pilots. He had like this big round bed with mirrors on the walls. One pilot told me the story of how he was flying a private jet when Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell hit the jackpot for bad behavior. Epstein had been invited to travel on a friend's jet from Palm Beach back to New York City. First, he arrives 20 minutes late. Strike one. Then he showed up with Maxwell, who hadn't been invited. Strike two. The jet had a bedroom for the billionaire to sleep on overnight trips to Europe. About halfway into the two-hour flight, the pilot went back to check on his boss to see if he needed anything. He didn't see Epstein or Maxwell, but he saw that the jet's owner was plenty pissed. "They're in the back, effing with the doors closed," the pilot says. "Epstein and Ghislaine, and you can hear them. I mean, really, it's a two-hour flight." Strike three. Forstman liked to send his empty Gulfstream jet over to Luton Airport in London to pick up Princess Diana, then separated from Prince Charles, and bring her back to Westhampton on Long Island to be with him. On the way to London, Forstman's otherwise empty jet would have on it the two pilots flying, plus another two pilots for the way back, with the first set of pilots flying back commercial, and one or two flight attendants. How the princess was listed on the flight manifest was a matter of some debate, since there are criminal penalties for lying on FAA records. There was a huge fight about what was actually signed for, says someone familiar with what transpired. And ultimately, we got to Diane Spencer, handwritten. It could be some cleaning lady. Next photos, Gulfstream Chairman Ted Forstman and a Gulfstream 5 in Los Angeles, 1997. The main lounge of a twin-aisle VIP aircraft. Elton John on a private Boeing, complete with piano bar, 1974. The pilots and crew on these planes get to travel widely and see how the other half lives, of course. But it's not a picnic. You are always on call. You'd better get along with the other pilots and the flight attendants, because they are almost always the same people. You're never quite sure where you are going, and when, and for how long. You're going to fly 30-40 hours a month, Dowd tells me, but you do a lot of sitting. You fly to Aspen, and sit there for 2, 3, 4 days. You fly to Palm Beach, and sit there for 2, 3, 4 days. You could be in some great places, but you're not with who you want to be with. Jets are deeply tied to their owner's status, their ego, their very being. The writer Rich Cohen once traveled on Jan Winner's Gulfstream II jet to follow the Rolling Stones tour. He recalled leaving Teterboro, New Jersey, with another Rolling Stone editor to fly to East Hampton to pick up Winner, then the owner of the magazine, for the flight to Toronto to see the band perform that night. "We were sitting on the runway," Cohen recalls, "and like a G4 taxied next to us, and Jan went crazy about how, 'Now my plane looks like a piece of shit.' He was being half sarcastic, but there was just an element of seriousness about it that was very funny. Other business executives complain about how pathetic they feel when they lose a job where they had regular access to a private jet and then don't. The plane is the game changer," Cohen says. "Basically, there are people with the plane and people without the plane, and those are the only two classes that matter. Once you have a plane, that's it. And if you have a plane, to go to a job where you don't have a plane, you almost can't do it." A couple of years before Winner sold his company, he had to sell his jet. Forstman was one of the first to realize that a whole new class of uber-wealthy Wall Street deal guys, like him, had emerged and would not be able to resist owning a private jet, not only for its efficiency and the freedom it provided, but also as the ultimate status symbol that virtually screams F-U. Ironically, he was also scared to death of flying. His regular seat on the jet had indentation marks from where he gripped it so tightly in fear. The reason that he was so interested in Gulfstream was because it was the only way he could do his business, says someone who knew him well, because otherwise he couldn't. It sounds crazy, but he couldn't get on a commercial flight. When Forstman first bought Gulfstream, he remembered asking the head of sales at the company how he went about making a pitch. "When you are selling a plane, how do you do it?" Forstman asked him. "What do you mean?" the guy responded. "He's the head of sales," Forstman reminded me. I said, "I mean, how do you do it? Who do you call?" He said, "I don't understand the question." "You're trying to make a sale," Forstman persisted. "You're going to call somebody. Whom do you call? Do you call the CEO? The CFO? Who do you call?" "Oh, I get what you're saying," he replied finally. "We're Gulfstream. We don't make calls. We take orders." "He was a great guy, a really nice guy, but he was gone in a week," Forstman told me. And for those people who can't afford their own private jet, a Moscow-based company, Private Jet Studio, lets them pretend that they can by allowing anyone to pose next to and inside a Gulfstream jet while it remains firmly on the ground the entire time. For around $200 for a 2-hour session, a photographer will take pictures of you and your fabulous pretend private jet, all of which, of course, can be immediately posted on Instagram for wider circulation and general fabulousness. The private jet tarmac can also be a place for private meetings. For instance, in June 2016, toward the end of the 2016 presidential campaign, former President Bill Clinton hopped from the private jet he was on at a Phoenix airport to the private jet used by Loretta Lynch, then the U.S. Attorney General. They spoke inside Lynch's jet for about 20 minutes, giving the Trump campaign plenty of ammunition to wonder what they were talking about, and to conclude they must have been trying to rig the election somehow for Clinton's wife, Hillary. It certainly was an awkward meeting at best. I would have much preferred a story that the Attorney General turned a former president of the United States away on the tarmac, Melanie Newman, then the Justice Department's head of the Office of Public Affairs, told the department's inspector general. But she doesn't make mistakes, and she was not pleased with herself for making this kind of high-stakes mistake. How did we get to this place where a private jet is the ultimate aspiration. According to Sean Vick, the chairman and CEO of Global Jet Capital, which provides financing for companies and individuals buying private jets, the concept of private jet travel began to emerge after World War II, when scores of people had seen firsthand how productive and efficient aircraft could be. Whether it's moving goods, supplies, parts, or cargo, or mail, creating an exponential increase in productivity and in capabilities. The early pioneers could be found in the 1950s and 1960s with Bill Lear, the founder of Learjet, now owned by Bombardier, Lockheed, and Hawker de Havilland, a British manufacturer. Vic likes to remind people that the Wright brothers made their first successful flight in 1903, that the first non-stop transatlantic flight was in 1919, and that man landed on the moon in 1969. This is the entire aviation aerospace continuum, he says. There are now 6 manufacturers of private jets and some 40 different models. About 14,150 private jets, a small club, are now operating in the United States and Canada. Big corporations such as Xerox, GE, and IBM were the early adopters of private jet travel. They realized that it was a productivity tool, allowing executives to travel around the country safely and unimpeded, visiting plants and facilities not easily reached by commercial jets. What was their collective experience, Vic says? They'd come out of World War II. They'd seen the utility these airplanes provided, and they were like, look, we need to get from point A to point B quickly and efficiently. And now we're taking trains, planes, and automobiles to do that. If we had our own airplane, how would this work? And they liked the answer. Well, there may be more than 400 commercial airports in the United States. There are more than 5,000 airports that serve private jets. It's a competitive issue, Vic continues. As businesses got large enough, could afford the operating expense of these assets, had the requirement to service global supply chains, and needed their people to be very productive, very secure, very efficient, with the demands on their time for a tens of billions of dollars enterprise, it's not too difficult to understand why the assets are valued like they are in order to deliver that kind of productivity. The stock market bonanza that started in 1982 brought with it a new wave of corporate raiders, junk bond financiers, and high-profile investment bankers doing huge M&A deals for ridiculous fees, along with the emergence of the private equity and hedge fund industries. Slowly but surely, these people were making ungodly amounts of money and were suddenly able to afford the luxury of a private jet, which can cost tens of millions to buy new, and then millions more each year to operate, between the cost of pilots, flight attendants, housing, and maintenance. Then, of course, there is the cost of the helicopters needed to get from Manhattan to airports in such places as Farmingdale, Long Island, or Teterboro. Jets also add an element of magic to a Wall Street banker's life, as if the money weren't enough. During my first week at Chase Manhattan Bank, where the late Jimmy Lee recruited me to join the burgeoning M&A group he was building, I was off on one of the bank's private jets to Bermuda for a day of golfing with one of Chase's best clients, the Boston-based buyout firm Thomas H. Lee Partners, which had just bought and sold Snapple, making a fortune. The Lee guys had flown down to Bermuda on their own private jet. We flew on ours. I remember arriving in Teterboro early for the flight. Couldn't risk being late, of course, and taking the first seat that I saw. As it turned out, that was Lee's seat, and woe unto the person who made the mistake of sitting in it. Another time, still at Chase, I was trying to sell Airphone, the business owned by Bell Atlantic that provided exclusive in-flight phone service on commercial and private jets. It was an interesting moment in time before cell phones were ubiquitous and commercial airlines agreed to allow their use. Airphone was immensely profitable, something like 50% EBITDA margins, but the fear, correct in the end, was that the business would disappear. The question was how quickly that would happen. Forstman and his partners wanted an early look at trying to buy the company and agreed to pay full price if they liked it. Off we went together to Chicago, where Airphone was based. We took the Forstman little helicopter from the Westside Heliport to Teterboro, right across the Newark Airport airspace. Then we boarded the Forstman little Gulfstream jet with a big FL logo on the tail. This was before Forstman got his own jet. It was quite the experience. Plush leather seats, anything we wanted to eat and drink inside a powerful jet that seemed to take off by going straight up before reaching a cruising altitude of something like 45,000 feet. The Airphone deal was a bust, but the memories of playing gin rummy for high cash stakes with the two late Forstman brothers in that luxurious private jet linger on and on. The G-forces a high-end jet can produce sexualize wealth. Straight up, what a feeling. All that money has been turned into power you can feel, that you can summon on a whim. It's something transcendent. No wonder it's the super-rich addiction. Do you know what a pain in the ass it is to have one? The private equity executive continues rhetorically. You've got to have pilots. You've got to have insurance. You've got to have a hangar. You've got to have somebody to deal with it. You've got to pay payroll. And everybody does it. It's crazy. It's like the most important status symbol. It's like the folded shirts in The Great Gatsby. It's the same idea. Remember when Jay folds his shirts in the armoire? Same idea. Of course, part of the beauty of Gatsby's shirts is that they're Gatsby's. No one else has them. No one else can afford them. Even more so, private jets mark the super rich as a separate class, insular, at a remove from everyone else, just like Wolfe envisioned. Anand Giridharadas, the best-selling author of Winners Take All, thinks this phenomenon is a problem, and not only for the have-nots. Let me address this to anybody who has felt the need to buy an airstrip in New Zealand to feel safe, he says. Let me address them directly. If you feel the need to buy an airstrip in New Zealand to feel safe, you may not be living right. You may not be running your business right. You may not be paying your taxes properly. Like if you need a James Bond-like escape plan from the potential rage of the public, the thing that might make you even safer than that airstrip is asking yourself how you have been complicit in the public getting so angry and how you can help reverse it. Just a thought. Or do it your way.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections from Vienna Gold, waltzes, marches, and polkas, a tribute to Johann Strauss, the London Festival Orchestra, conducted by Eric Rogers.